Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin.
A composite show, archive segments from previous episodes that got cut due to time. Record over episode 252 with Dan Q, the Mean Team, Matt Jin, Canis Albinus, and Matt Zed.
By iJerry2595i. Yes, okay. I will say the I's at the start and the end of Jerry's name and numbers. But I got an amusing video here called No Spain, No Gain. It's only a minute or so long, a little bit over a minute long, so worth a glance. Covering, well, a certain discovery by Isabella.
Yeah, apparently it's Jerry's favorite Civ. In Civ 5.
Yeah. I think one of the more interesting points is that Isabella was fully rigged as a leader, which means that she can be fully articulated if you can actually pull out all of the code and yes. The art, which meant that it made it really easy to pull her into doing a different video.
There's been some suggestions to use, like, Shaka in future videos as well, yes.
Based on a screen capture of the next one, it looks to involve Catherine and Bismarck. And yes, I'm totally avoiding talking about a fully articulated Isabella in some fashions.
Rig. Oh. Basically, what the video is about is Isabella running around with her quote-unquote settlers following her until she finds Skeldorado.
And she's got all the bling.
Yeah, and she has all the bling.
But I most like, in terms of comments, that I saw a Dude McBob on Reddit. She looks pretty confident considering she's holding like $8. But then again, there's 5,000 years of inflation on that.
Yep.
This person, based on the positive feedback they received, including the number of likes on YouTube to the video, which is, I believe, over 100 last time I checked, and there's almost 2,300 views in just a week and a half. It's like, yep, I'm going on to the next one. They gave a preview, and they're being encouraged to essentially do one for every civilization, although part of is a limitation in terms of leader articulation and how much overhead there is to trying to actually do that. But quite frankly, I'd just be happy with what they have in store for the next one. I mean, yeah, if you play Civilization in general, you can appreciate this, but if you don't play Civilization 5 specifically, there's definitely some things that are going to be lost, you know, unless you just like watching Isabella run, which, you know, I mean, there's that.
There's this comment on Reddit for the video that I liked by Job007, saying that I'm sure someone will request one featuring Gandhi, and we all know how that will end. I want to see a Gandhi video for this. Can only imagine.
Recorded for episode 254 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mean Team, Anzleon, and Fyar. Civilization 4 tops a video game songs with lyrics list on the WatchMojo YouTube channel, which we featured before. Quote, the most memorable songs from video games that aren't purely instrumental. To qualify, the song must be specifically written for a video game, so licensed songs, they already have a list of their own. And because of the tough competition, only one song per franchise is allowed. Although, quite frankly, when it comes to Civilization, I don't see anything coming close to Baba Yetu, the score for the original Civilization 4, and by that, of course, I mean Vanilla from Christopher Tin, and it was number one on the list.
Civ 4 blew our minds from its opening title screen, and that's primarily because of this grand, all-encompassing theme. Baba Yetu is a song that speaks to us on several different levels. Hearing it, you almost feel as you can hold the entire world in the palm of your hand. At the same time, it will make you feel as if you're just a small part of something greater.
And what's even more humorous, and perhaps is often lost in the lore that is this song, it was not intended to be the original theme for Civilization IV. The original theme for Civilization IV, the licensing effort, did not go through. And so Baba Yetu was created in turn as a result of that action. So whatever that song was, thank you. Thank you for not allowing that licensing to go through.
Now I'm really curious as to what the hell they were trying to license.
Yeah.
I'm curious, was Baba Yetu originally a Swahili folk song that they turned into the Civ 4 theme song? Or
no, it was specifically composed. Christopher Tin was specifically contracted to write this song for Civilization 4.
Okay. Because, since the lyrics are, in fact, just the Lord's Prayer.
In Swahili, yeah.
Just it, but I wasn't sure if maybe the melody was already something that was done in Swahili culture.
No.
But no, the melody was actually written.
And then, as we know, not that I necessarily take a lot of stock in winning a Grammy Award or an Emmy Award for major entertainment productions out of Hollywood, but it was the first game, not just Civ, but first game to win a Grammy for music. To show you that it is possible to have a really good score that's not just good for the game, but is good in general.
Yeah.
Recorded for episode 279 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Majin, and Kalina.
There's a pretty cool talk that came up at GDC this last year with the Civ devs when they were chatting about continuing the series past 5 and what things would be good to improve on and what they changed between the games. And taking a read of it, there's a breakdown in a Google Doc that's a little bit more in-depth on some of the comments when you only have the slides.
Well, it was very helpful that there was that Google Doc, because if you would like to subscribe individually to get access to this from the Game Developer Conference Vault, it's going to cost you $500.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, if you're going to be watching multiple videos, that's one thing. But if it's like, I just want to watch this, I mean, maybe you are Mr. and Miss Moneybags, I shouldn't assume. But for me, the only way I really, quote-unquote, know what was being talked about beyond the description was looking at this Google Doc.
I mean, granted, if you go to GDC, you can get access to the vault.
That's true. There's also the question of timing and money and all these other things. But still, yes, notwithstanding those very practical things, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
5 problems they felt that they had to solve, and this came from Ed Beach, the designer for Civilization VI. The rote tile decisions, hence the unstacking city approach, and Imagine would appreciate that reference specifically. The disjointed tech tree, which Imagine probably doesn't appreciate to a certain degree. Seems like you've got your own mod out there for a technology tree, but you can't talk about that on the show. You have to get back on Modcast.
No, I already did my pass-through Modcast.
Problem 3. Oh, you've been there, done that, huh? Wow, we see.
Uh-huh.
The social policy path. Always tradition, never
listen. Like there wasn't 2 others, by the way.
Yeah, there wasn't.
I mean, in practice, there wasn't.
Actually, yeah. You know the funniest thing? Just as a totally aside and referencing a completely different game. As much as social policies were a thing in Civ 5 and people had their issues with them, Stellaris went and basically stole the concept, at least picked up the concept for their traditions in mm-hmm. the new expansion. It's exactly the same.
No, I believe the term you're looking for, Imagine, is appropriation. And
they reaccommodated the social policy into a new game because Civ 6 didn't use it, so it needed to be reaccommodated. I'm just suggesting that the design of Civ 5 social policies has continued to live in other locations.
Ah,
yes.
Problem number 4 was unit congestion in relation to the 1 unit per tile. And problem number 5, cheating the terrain. That one, when I first saw that, I'm like, what are you referring to exactly? According to the Google Doc, worried players would be confused about the focus on terrain and worried it would be frustrating. Say you want the pyramids and there's no stone. Annoying, potentially. An awkward strategy in Civ 5. Always end units in awkward terrain for the defense boost. And they wanted to fix that in Civilization 6.
That feels pretty disconnected to me. I still have some problems with the thought process that went into that and whether it actually accomplished what he believed it would accomplish.
I think it's actually accomplishing some parts. There is some things that should probably be changed with movement, but the concept that basically, hey, look, I've got 3 move on this unit, and therefore I can cross 2 hills with my 3 move unit. Or I have an actual 4 move unit and can cross 2 hills.
That's still in play, though, because you can have 2 moves or 3 moves, and you can still only go into that one tile if you're in bad terrain.
Well,
like, that's always going to be a thing.
No, but that's backward. Now it's shifted it backwards. So instead of being able to go faster than you possibly could, you go slower than you possibly could.
But mobility is mobility and tactical positioning is a huge part of the unit design in the game.
No,
the position of your units against the enemy units matters more when the enemy units are more mobile when you're misplaced. And this change makes everybody's units globally less mobile. The punishment for being caught out of position is reduced as a result
no,
in a number of ways.
It's increased, actually.
It's decreased. There's no question. It's decreased.
Well, say you've got an archer, and you take a step back. In Civ 5, if you take a step back into plains, then you can take a step back into that forested hill, and therefore you could get away, move forward, and get into the hill at the same time. Possibly could, but it'd be a lot harder. Whereas in Civ 6, if you take a step back, you can't jump onto that forested hill, and then you're going to be ran down by that melee unit that was trying to chase you.
Unless you step into the forested hill right away, using all your movement, yeah. And then they can't possibly attack you the following turn, because they are at least one hex from where you were. Even if they were next to you, they can't attack you because of that.
Yeah, that's a bit of a problem.
unless they have a great general.
Yeah,
so like, you're not changing a lot in practice here, but surprise attacks on back line, in principle, should be a big deal, but it's very difficult to pull that off now because of the terrain changes.
Oh, and you got chasing, the constant chase. You can never catch me if we're in rough terrain, because I'm always one step ahead of you. Although there's some minor things that could change to make it a little better, like allowing attacks if you have a movement point into terrain that you can't move into. So if you have one movement point left and you obviously haven't attacked anything, or you got a movement ability to attack so that you can attack into the wooded territory, but even if you kill the unit, you don't move into it. That would reduce the chase.
That would reduce the chase, but it would be a very interesting play with people trying to pick off units and not expose themselves.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be able to have an archer constantly
outrunning a warrior without being attackable. Yeah.
So you'd be able to catch up. My other problem with it is mounted units. Just by default, they can move faster than walking units in rough terrain, especially in wooded rough terrain and hills and stuff. And that's not really the case. Mounted units are really only faster than melee units on roads or open terrain.
And not even at the strategic level, if you're talking about reality. So, yeah, I mean, I guess you could give them, like, a charging bonus or something, or make them do more damage from flank, but reduce their base movement and make them move a little better on flatland, something like that.
Yeah, or when it comes to rough terrain, make them cost twice as much. That way you can keep the movement points the same. So if they're on open terrain, they can run around. And then you wouldn't necessarily want to use all cav type units, because you wouldn't be able to run through heavy terrain faster. But, you know, if you've got a road through that heavy terrain, yes, the horses should be able to go faster than walking people, in theory. I mean, that's kind of two points I would change on the movement-related stuff. And that might balance things out a little bit more towards melee units.
It would be a start. I just feel like the game does not take advantage of its potential with terrain nearly as much as it could.
I actually have a preference for this style where if you don't have the full movement, you can't get in. But it needs some adjustments to make it a little bit better and make it feel better.
Yeah, I guess if you tweaked it enough, it wouldn't bother me nearly so much.
And for more on this problem and the other problems that were identified, this is all part, again, of Ed Beach's GDC 2017 talk, Absolutely No Pressure, Continuing a Successful Game Series in Civilization VI.
Recorded for episode 283 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Mad Jin, and Mega Bears Fan.
I do think that all naval units should have the ability to heal when they're adjacent to land. Maybe not if it's like a mountain tile, but...
I know, because all? So your battleship with that giant hole in it is just going to set up on this deserted island and
patch it up.
Heal? Yeah, because they have like an entire infrastructure sitting there to manufacture all the stuff the battleship needs.
Well, I mean, again, you're talking about abstractions. Does it make equal sense? Does it make equal sense for your tank to be able to do that in the middle of a desert with no cities or infrastructure near it? I mean, it's an abstraction of supply lines.
Yeah. And the land-based ones are more fuzzy than the naval-based ones. I prefer no upgrades of units unless they're within range of an encampment. How about that?
I'm not opposed to that.
I would have no problem saying a land unit needs to move into friendly territory, and that should be your territory, friendly territory of an AI, or if you're the suzerain of a city-state, that's fine. That should be a thing.
Supply line just for healing outside of territory could be within range of cities and encampments.
Oh! Or you can have it so that if you're really concerned about being able to heal, say, for example, a tank in the middle of a desert, if you want that ability, you should escort it with a support unit. Not as fast, perhaps, at healing as if it was within friendly territory, but it could be something better than nothing.
Yeah, support units. That whole
like having a repair corps that follows everybody around?
Yeah, because they are your supply line.
Oh, there you go. And everybody can have the supply line thing that they wanted, but it's not so ridiculous as some of the suggestions have been.
That doesn't really help with my one exploring galley that ends up getting stuck behind closed borders and then just has to sit there until something comes and kills it.
Well, that's your own fault for getting stuck behind closed borders. Use diplomacy.
No. Declare a war. Oh, that is diplomacy. Never mind.
If it gets stuck behind closed borders on the coast, then push up your technology so that it can go into the ocean and escape those borders.
Yes, and that is one thing that I do like, that all naval units get the ability to cross ocean when you get to cartography. So, you can get that unit out of there in that situation.
Yep.
Without having to go back to your home territory.
Yeah, to learn.
Ah!
Yeah, like stupid scouts in Civ 5 don't have that problem anymore. Like, I could throw myself in the water, but I don't know how to do that. Wait, we just learned how to throw ourselves in the water. Maybe I should go home to learn how to do that. What?
Yeah, at least we don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah. But yeah, I more agree that naval units need to be near a harbor to heal. It doesn't have to be yours. I agree with that. If you have friendly people, you should be able to heal in their territory.
Record over episode 286 with Dan Q, Akalua, Mimi and team, Imagine, and Proud.
And Civ War was so egregious. The amount of war weariness that the AI would not get on the high levels. Like, you could shred 100-plus units in your territory, and just it would have, like, maybe plus one for war weariness of unhappiness. It was absurd.
Well,
so I guess that's not a thing in Civ 6. It's good.
Well, no, just keep in mind that most rebel units can't fight walls. So.
Yeah.
If there's walls up, you're going to have to break those walls down to let the rebels attack them. Otherwise, they'll just die. Like, rebels in Civ 6 are not something to care about. Like, oh no, you're going to pillage a few tiles before I kill you with a city range bombardment.
I find them mostly a nuisance.
Yeah.
They're going against unwalled cities. I guess they can be a problem. But otherwise, it's like, well, can't send any builders there or do anything until I take armies and go there and deal with that crap.
Yep.
Thanks. Or the worst is when they pop up in enemy cities and block you, and it is, you lose time on that because you have to then get them out of the way before you attack this city. It's noxious.
Yeah, or they leave that city and go to your cities and stuff.
Yeah.
A nuisance of himself.
Yeah, because that's...
No, that would be easy to deal with. I just don't like them blocking me when I'm trying to take this city. If they're heading towards me, I can put a unit to block them and shoot at it, and they'll do minimal damage, but...
Yeah, no, that's that is one problem with rebels, is that they are barbs, so they get the barb AI, rather than their own separate rebel AI. So they will instantly pop up and go, okay, let's act like barbs, and... Well, that has some small problems because barbs will suicide themselves against the person who wiped out their camp. And since these rebels spawn and have no camp, they'll just instantly start charging at somebody. I wouldn't doubt that it defaults to the player. They probably need their own little AI to stay within the territory.
Well, yeah. Yeah, because otherwise it's, you know, I'm a rebel, although, as you say, in the game, I'm a barbarian, so I've rebelled against this, the particular rule of this civ. I'm right outside the city that's very, very unhappy. Hey, let's go over to the next door neighbor and start smashing on them.
Yeah.
And before suggestions to copy the separatist rebel mechanic from Paradox, lol.
Oh my gosh, no. And they'll even move without even pillaging on their way out. It's just like, they're gone.
They don't even bother to pillage anything. Like, hey, we're rebels! Free army, go.
Most of the time I look at the rebels and I'm like, can you move out of the hex so I can move my units around? You're like, missionary spam, please leave. And that's they really should be more threatening than that, because it's like, I don't have a lot of amenities. Oh well, barbs have spawned. Eh, who cares?
No, what should happen is that you get one rebel unit per war weariness sitting on that city. And then, of course, it wipes out the war weariness in the city temporarily.
Well, yeah, seeing as how the people that were upset are left, so they're not both rebels and still in the city.
So, yeah, they should reduce pop as well for spawning. You can have big army spawn, and then they would actually attempt to take that city. And then also that means that you can't jack up 9 or warriness on a one pop city and get 9 units out of it. You'd only get 1. Well, I guess at that point the city would disappear because they rebelled and walked away. And then what would be even better is if they don't burn the city down. But they actually take it. That would be better.
Yeah, could you not burn the things down? That would be great. Thanks.
Well, I mean, they're rebels. They're looking to get rid of the rule of the person, not set the whole place on fire.
Yeah.
Although that does tend to happen. But generally, they have this concept of also wanting to still live in the city.
Then maybe suddenly if they take your city, or they take whatever city of someone else that they're attacking, oh, look, there's a new civ in the game. Hi. Recorded for episode 284 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Mad Jin, and Canuck Soldier.
So, move your troops. Sherlock at Civ Fanatics complaining that the AI basically tells you to screw off because you got troops on their border, but you ignored the request. You're getting told you broke the promise you didn't make. So this is a bit of a conceptual design issue with the way the developers designed this diplomacy, as opposed to, you know, maybe the way we would react to each other in a multiplayer game.
In the thread, X-Virus, honestly, I feel you should get more negativity from them for ignoring. How would you feel if you sent a letter via pigeon hundreds of miles to your neighbor, only for it never to be opened? I mean,
I don't get the logic on this one.
I could see you being ticked off if you got no response. I mean, no response isn't itself a response. But if you go out of your way in a situation to say, fine, I'll move them, and then you don't, that is a promise. Your ignoring the request is not breaking a promise.
Yeah.
You didn't do anything. You ignored them. Now, Nigel to Funnel 2 says, I'm in the habit of just hitting the escape key to ignore the request, and I don't suffer penalties later if my troops are around. And I remember this being an issue in Civ 5 where the game wouldn't recognize escape as a response. So you're actually ignoring the ignoring, but I haven't tried that in Civ 6 yet.
Solid. Solid implementation right there.
Yeah.
Which is another separate issue, but yeah, I agree. If you tell the AI, you click on the button, ignore this request, and by the way, thank you for Axon 2K for adding that option, but don't have it be a false choice in the sense that, well, I might as well just say screw off because I'm just going to get the penalty anyway. I can at least get the satisfaction of telling you, no, I'm not doing it.
Hmm.
As I was kind of getting at, I could see a sliding scale of negativity. That you should get something more severe for breaking a promise, and you could get like a minor ding for ignoring them. It's like, I've sent you a concern. You should respond. Don't ignore me. Although at the same time, then someone could say, if you tell ignore the request, and then you move your troops away, actions speak louder than words, so then you actually get some kind of bonus. At the very least, don't penalize us for not doing something. In that case, as it's designed right now, it should just be a null. There was an attempt at a diplomatic interaction from the AI, and you decided not to engage.
Yeah, that has its own penalty, diplo penalty. There actually is a separate thing between saying that you're not going to move them and saying that you don't care. There's a specific difference right now between not moving and totally ignoring them in the code. It exists. And they're different numbers.
By saying you ignore the request means that you're not going to move them, probably. I mean, that's why you probably, you know.
You don't say.
Exactly, so.
Yeah, really, this is one line of code for a different response, really. I mean,
yep. Like, I get what they're getting at, but it's,
No, it is all there. Promise kept or broken is a thing on top of that. So you don't get that if you ignore them.
Yeah, pretty much.
Recorded for episode 285 with Dan Q, Makalua, Matt Jin, New Earth Relic, and TJ Denzer.
It's all, look at the open mic. It has been opened. There's a battery. There are some wires.
There's this thing that's called feedback. Everybody likes just talking about navel. That's about what I got out of this thread.
They like talking about your navel. Got it.
Yeah. They like just talking about naval battle stuff, and they're glad to see we were going to be talking about Air Force today. So there you go. Did I miss anything?
No, he's absolutely right. They like talking about battling with your belly buttons. Yeah, it's real interesting.
Sea battles.
Innie versus outies, and it's just a real war, and it's just, oh, I tell you.
The war against Lent is an ongoing conflict.
Uber Frog was like, great episode, guys. I was glad you discussed the naval thread. It's an area of the game that still manages to feel pretty basic, even though they ship the game with features like coastal raiding and privateers. I totally agree that religious units need to be their own layer, says Willowbrook. Thanks for all the work you guys put into making these episodes. Aw. Timothy001 also really liked the discussions on naval and the religious combat. I totally agree that naval combat is underdeveloped. I find that religious combat can become tedious. I have won exactly one religious victory in 600 hours played, and that was for the achievement. And it was Timothy who had said that he would like to see us discuss air combat, or lack of it, and how things would change if the AI were competent with it. So, there you go. I happened to find a thread that was talking just about that as I was thinking about just adding that as a topic to the show without having a thread to link to it, but it was both there, and I thought, this is a sign. I saw the sign, and it opened up my eyes. And last but not least, from Fotai, I've caught the last 6 or 7 episodes almost as good as the real thing, or even better when I don't feel like sitting at my desk. Well, if you had it on a laptop or something, you wouldn't have to sit at your desk and place it necessarily. But we're almost as good as the real thing. I like that. I like that. That's our new tagline, almost as good as the real thing.
Recorded for episode 289 with Makalua, the Mian team, Mad Jin, Ixnay, and Mike W.
Apparently, some people liked our last episode that had no Dan. It was great. lacked Phil, too. But, you know, we had to let you guys come back one at a time. Otherwise, it would be too much of a shock to people's listening after having Mackie and I running the place.
Did Drew really swear that much because I didn't hear it?
I don't think he swore that much. He probably threw one or two in there, but I don't think he swore that much. Dan's a really good editor, so he's even edited my memory of it.
Okay, if you're editing your memories, welcome to being a synth, I guess.
I've got some nerve staples. I could use them.
Oh, Phil, you still have the nerve staple gun. Why?
Why wouldn't I have it? It's very high utility.
Or something. I don't know. Drew wanted to expand on the discussions about the World Congress that we had and the diplomatic victory. You wanted to keep talking about it. Instead of a diplo victory, it could be determined based on your government type and some other criteria. For example, perhaps a diplomatic victory would be focused on getting your Tier 3 government and performing actions that make your government type appear the strongest government out of any other governments. So basically, ideological wars.
Yeah, so conquer everybody, then you're the strongest government.
Exactly. The whole ideological stuff from Civ 5, Cold War, democracy versus communism. But then you'd have to be the best form of government. So, just if there's multiple democracies, you'd have to be the best democracy out of all the democracies.
And how are you measuring that, by excess happiness or something?
I think it would be hard to do this in a non-contrived fashion. I really do.
Yeah, but especially with multiple people in the game.
Yeah.
It starts getting a little weird. I mean, there's something
there. How
do you
balance this against the military?
Yeah. See, I think the diplomatic victory is basically a conquest victory condition just in a peaceful way.
Yeah, like when a bunch of MP players are like, okay, that guy's going to win, so we'll just call it a game and say he wins. Because they don't want to play through, go through the motions for 30 turns.
But yeah, I would also suggest you need to at least get to Tier 3 government before diplomacy victory pops out. So, Timothy, who usually watches, missed Dan and Phil.
Aww.
Oh, I missed you guys.
He spelled out each word of my name, the me and team.
Yeah.
I like it.
And then Dan lied. Both Phil and I expect to be back for episode 289 shortly after
he
wrote.
He expects to be back.
Yeah, no, right. Shortly after he wrote that, he's like, Madge, can you take over?
Yeah. I had something come up, guys. LOL.
Yep. Of course, like the fact that we were back to talking about lots of ideas and kicking ideas around, which was pretty much true in there. But more importantly, somewhere down the path, still on the Diplo victory side, Sheglio brought up that there's a mod called Civ 6 Reformation Victories by Grey Tiger, so that includes a diplomatic victory. His terms for that one are, to achieve victory, you need to have peace with all civs, embassies with all major civs, and have alliances with at least 2 civs. You also need to be Caesarian of at least 3 city-states. Again, it doesn't rely solely on the city-state stuff, which would be useful, but they're a small factor. And it's more about your diplomacy, using diplomacy to get a diplomatic victory.
This gets utterly denied in any competitive setting by one person declaring war.
Yeah, well.
Or really anybody who's trying to win declaring war.
Yeah. So that's why I suggested somewhere along the line, but just go allied with X percent of the world's population.
Yeah, okay.
Because then you can be Caesarian of a vast field of city-states, which would consider being allied. Or you could ally up with other big civs and mass pop it. And then later on, good relations would probably be useful, no ongoing wars. Basically, it's the we've made peace concept. And then that person who declares war to prevent you from getting a diplomatic victory, well, that's just the final battle. They declare war to prevent you from winning the diplomacy slash passive peaceful victory condition. So you wipe them out, and now you have no reason to war again.
I feel like any major civ should just try to fight you to death or give up, like, not do that.
Yeah, but I would also consider, I mean, in my concept of diplo victory would not be an individual victory. It would be a combined group.
Oh, okay.
So you don't lose.
So you actually have some incentive to use it.
Yeah, you don't. Sense. You don't lose to a diplo victory because one person made the alliance. Everybody would quote unquote win. So it would be the fallback to the concept of, okay, we're not going to win war because that person's too strong. So let's get together on diplo-VC or your individual victories. So space race or culture are getting stalled or religions getting stalled. Yada yada yada. Now, granted, for the diplo side, once you get into alliances like that, I would suggest that it would be almost impossible to get out unless something really bad happened or a series of bad things happened. That way you can't be part of an alliance and then duck out at the last second.
Just betrayal.
Yeah.
Here, have 15 nukes.
Yep. So, yeah, you wouldn't be able to do that, but you should be able to get out of the alliances. So, if, say, the other people in your alliance all flipped communism and you're the democracy, well, yeah. That's a reason to back out. A reason. It'd have to be more than just that. But then, yeah, aim it towards an alliance of the world's pop. So you're looking for hegemony. You don't have to get everybody. But if you've managed to pacify enough of the world, then it would work. And, of course, just because you're in an alliance that's the level of the diplo-VC plan doesn't mean that you can't just sneak off into a space race victory or a culture victory.
Yeah.
So it would also actually make it easier to win tourism victory if you're in an alliance because your culture would be stronger or the religion.
Well, then don't your allies lose?
Well, in that case, they would lose.
Then what recourse do they have against that? Well, could they turn on you?
Well, possibly. There's a risk-reward factor in there. But
depending, I don't mind ending a game that's over earlier. I'm all for that. But like, I want to make sure these incentives make sense.
Yeah, yeah. There would be a requirement to go through and do proper balancing and risk rewards for doing it. Because I think a diplo mass alliance would have to have risks associated with it. Otherwise, you'd get stuff like, well, we're all just going to ally and haha, we win, you lose. It shouldn't be that easy.
There's six players and five players ally on like turn seven.
Yeah.
Well, you lose.
Yeah. It shouldn't be that easy.
Garak Scrub.
Yep. No, it should be a late game victory, just like all the other ones. I don't believe it should require a vote in a World Congress. I think that's just a really bad mechanic to bring back. Just
I
don't
vote
do
blue.
It.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, don't do it. Or I'm forced not to vote for myself. Wait, what? Please don't bring that back for a diplo victory. But I would say if you can bring back permanent alliances, that sort of concept of more than two people at a time. Well, I'd say semi-permanent. I'd put that qualifier in it that you should still be able to leave a permanent alliance if your allies are being asses. But it would be a tight alliance, so as you grow the alliance, the longer you're in the alliance, the harder it is to back out. And of course, bring back vassals.
Yay! Oh, God.
Yep, and protectorate.
Like the 10th time I heard it today.
If we're, quote-unquote, bringing back vassals, we need to be bringing a new mechanic, not what Sifor did.
Yeah.
Especially well, not with the peace vassals. My gosh.
Yeah. Well,
the levels are broken, you could view, on either side of that garbage.
Yeah, no. I mean, I wouldn't let you crush somebody. You're my vassal, even though they're bigger than you. Like, if they're way bigger than you.
That actually was still better, though, because, like, it actually involved crushing somebody, as opposed to somebody just bending over and then feeding their overlord techs for no reason.
Yeah. No, there'd have to be better mechanics around vassals. Including vassals breaking away.
Yeah.
You'd have to.
And Sifor had a proper setup for that, but it didn't actually use it too consistently.
Yeah.
I don't mind it as an MP concept where, like, essentially, if you get smacked into vassalhood, you're fishing for a second.
Yeah. or it just takes the military victory off the table. But you could still get a religious or cultural or scientific victory as a vassal.
I want to see some incentive for vassals to actually fight with their overlord, though, because it's kind of the point. And so, like, if you're trying to win space and you've been vassaled, that's not going to happen. You're not going to be like, I'll spend hammers to send units for you and help you win faster as opposed to me winning. Like, they're not going to do it. So, like, I would almost say take victory off the table for people who have given up and accept vassaling.
Well, yeah.
You were fighting for second place at that point.
Yeah, but I would also put things in there for both being a vassal and for having vassals to push towards not being a vassal as you go. It also depends on form of government, stuff like that, who's stronger. Democracies would have pressure against having vassals of any sort and possibly even not be allowed to make vassals.
I wonder, though. Like, I wonder if that's actually justified and if that restriction helps the game in any sense.
Yeah. Well, it keeps people from going democracy if they want to go vassaling.
But, like, if you're going vassaling, you're already committing to military, which means
the
likelihood that you're running democracy
is pretty high because democracy is the better government out of the three. Because it's the economic one. It is better than communism and fascism.
You actually get unit strength from fascism, though.
Whoop-de-doo at that point.
And I guess if you're slinging nukes everywhere, but...
at that point, any extra little bits from that is not really important. The economic side of things is far more important.
Really difficult to make a good vassal system that works when the human is the vassal.
Yeah.
It's really difficult to do that.
But I'd also slip in there, like, agitations for, again, back to spies maybe, or part of it. If you conquer somebody and you keep all the cities, as you go through the ages, there's agitations to break away. Kind of like the rebellions, but might happen a little earlier or later, depending on how it's set up. Other than that, other people brought up stuff in the thread about the Diplo victory. Obviously, AI is kind of rough, but go figure. The whole voting thing, yeah, I still don't like it, but it keeps getting brought up.
Can have, like, a vote to end the game thing, like an MP or something.
Well, I mean, we really just don't want, hey, let's all go into a permanent alliance just to go, wee, we win. I don't want that sort of setup. Casperium tries to defend Civ 5's system for framework, even though the implementation was kind of rough.
Hey, you could do the Alpha Centauri thing, and just if you accrue so much money without spending it, you can just corner the market or something.
I bought everything.
But that's not really diplomatic, but it is a different victory condition that has some real constraints that could be a problem to attain, but might actually be a threat in a competitive setting.
Yeah.
It's not really Diplo.
No, I know. See, that's the biggest problem with Diplo victory through the Civ games, is that it's mostly been about the money, not about actual diplomacy.
But since, like, actual diplomacy in a game with a fixed winner is kind of iffy, I don't mind it being about the money, but then don't make the pretense that it's a diplomatic victory, just like an economic one.
Yep, which is why I would suggest that the Diplo victory would be a shared victory.
Yeah, that's so tough to implement, like, in a, say you got a 5-man free-for-all.
Yeah, well, that's part of, vassals would automatically be part of you.
But what incentive do you have to take a vassal if they can break free? And their primary incentive is to undermine you so that they can win.
Depends.
Like, why would you bother then? Unless they're, like, one of the last Civs on the board.
Well,
in which case, most people will call the game because you're going to crush them.
Yeah, well, there's that too. There need to be incentives for being a vassal of somebody else, but not something that you would peacefully
get
into.
There has to be, like, strong incentive for an overlord to take a vassal too, though.
You'd have to be able to prevent the vassal from undermining you in some way.
Yeah.
Or maybe you can integrate a vassal over time.
Well, then why would you accept to become a vassal?
Well, sometimes you don't have a choice.
Well, you do. You do have a choice. You can just refuse until you get conquered.
But then somebody could still make a vassal out of those conquered lands versus just keeping them. And maybe there would be some benefit to that, that they would be vassaled.
Maybe, but you're off the board, so you're never going to agree to it.
Well, yeah, but you can't always make a mechanic based on somebody just being a jerk. You have
it
to make most of it
set up as your incentive.
Yeah. Well, that's the biggest function.
Like, I don't mind a setup where if you become a vassal, you lose. You cannot win anymore. That's it. So, because then you have some incentive to operate in a way that helps the overlord rather than harming the overlord.
Yeah. Well, there should still be ways to get out of it, but yeah, there should be some incentives to being part of the team. But the problem is, when it comes to diplomacy, the moment you put people, like humans, in there, then there is no diplomacy anymore.
That is contingent on the incentives that they're given when playing. That's why I propose something so extreme. Like, if you cannot win anymore, but you can ensure that everybody other than the person vassaled you finishes worse, and you have some sort of scoring system over time, you have incentive to work to become the number two in that game. You will actually fight as a vassal for your overlord, and your overlord has incentive to take you as a vassal, and you have initial incentive to resist being a vassal, but if you can't win, then it makes sense to try and become number two instead. That's at least somewhat clear incentive to operate that way.
But then you can still be an annoyance to the person. So say you don't like the person who conquered you, and you as a player throw all your units in their way when they're trying to conquer somebody else. In a multiplayer setting, the overlord should have a button that says kick player.
Yeah, that is game throwing, and I'd be okay with kicking anybody who's game throwing. Like someone who just builds like 50 scouts and tries to flood somebody on the other side of a donut map and isn't trying to win. Like, I don't know if I'm kicking that guy either.
Yeah, but usually the host has that power. I would say in this case the overlord has the power.
Okay, that's fine.
At that point in a multiplayer game, if you're just being an ass, kick. Let the overlord do it. There's lots of edge case stuff that would have to be looked at when it comes to players.
It's true in general, but like the mechanics really need to factor that. This is one of the biggest flaws in the recent, well, really all Civ games, is that too many mechanics are dependent on operating against incentive to even function.
It becomes problematic when you put people in the game.
But it shouldn't. If you have players as agents, players as civs, if civs are representing a player entity in the game, the incentive should be fine. There should be some incentive to interact diplomatically that works for players. Introducing players should not cause a problem. The mechanic should be designed so that rational agents operating under the victory conditions will actually opt to do some of this stuff.
Yes, except players don't act rationally.
Okay, and players harden themselves. They don't always pick the optimal option. But the incentive should be there.
Yeah.
Regardless of how effectively the player plays the game, the incentives should exist.
Yeah. No, and that's the hardest part about using diplomacy for victory condition.
Yeah, it's really tough. Unless you really are just building a mechanic that says, okay, this guy's going to win no matter what we do, so let's just call the game.
Yeah.
In practice, that's what a real diplo victory is in MP.
Yep, pretty much. But then, wrapping back around to the beginning, the vassal would be part of the diplo victory.
Yeah.
So you'd have a shared victory that way.
Yeah, you would.
That'd be a small incentive. Since we're put around to diplomacy anyways.
Well, yeah, it effectively improves your final ranking standings if you do that.
Yeah. So you're at least alive and winning a shared victory versus not. I'd actually just say that the vassal would share the victory with their overlord. It doesn't matter the victory. They would just get a share.
I mean, I'm okay with the general sense of saying, okay, these both win. And then if you have MP rankings, you would give the number one more points, for example.
Yeah.
And people on the bottom end less, or lose points, or however you want to set that up.
Or you get more points. You know, like, if somebody goes and vassals everybody, then you'd give the person who was a vassal longer the most points.
Yeah. Something.
Out of the vassal points.
Yeah. It would impact the rankings.
Yeah. Because then they helped more.
At least allegedly.
Yeah.
If they didn't get
there. Allegedly, yeah.
Recorded for episode 290 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Fight, and Ziki Zarish.
Episode feedback.
Yeah, Mackie, you should talk more. We should give you the chance to talk more when you're not here.
Did you see that, Mackie? Did you see that?
Yes, I didn't even have to jump in and go, actually, I was talking more if you just listened a little bit longer. Everybody else jumped in and went, yeah, she was playing refrigerator Tetris. That's why she wasn't there. It wasn't because they were talking over me. I could talk over them quite well, actually.
Just so people get the full context of it, Stringer1313, this is the first time I've ever listened to a Polycast episode, but I had to stop listening at 20 minutes. I was really happy to see a female guest presence listed on the episode.
Yes.
But 20 minutes in.
Yes, yeah.
I ignored that in my comment. I was prioritizing, but yes, thank you for Phil for jumping in on that later in the thread. 20 minutes in, she hadn't said a word. I know that none of this is intentional, but I would strongly urge the Polycasters to make sure that female guests actually get to talk or speak up every once in a while. It would definitely help attract some new listeners.
And it's I think as Phil pointed out, we just have a problem with new guests in general feeling like they're intruding to jump in on us.
Yeah.
You know, And I do appreciate the thought from this person. You know, it's just, you, if you just listen a little bit longer.
And she's not a guest.
Well, yeah.
Not even a little bit.
That's kind of minor comparatively. It was funny, though.
Well, yeah.
And thanks to the magic of post-production, it's actually technically not true, because when Mackie said hello later in the recording, I put that in the introduction to the show, so that was within the first 20 minutes. Mackie did say a word. She said hello. So.
come on. Really? Are you going to go for technicalities here?
Wait, I'm sorry. You're asking me that question after 11 years on this show? What?
Yeah, I know.
Sprinkle that soundbite hello throughout the episode.
And if it's technically correct, it's the best correct.
Mm-hmm. But other than that particular comment, we're Frog. Entertaining as always. I especially agree with Madjin's final assessment. Quote, making people want to play Civ 6 again by talking about a better version of Civ 6. Unquote. We would like to think that's most episodes, but Madjin just happened to be the first to say it, and so succinctly. People seem to really enjoy the conversation about raising the minimum population for districts, including a pop requirement for buildings and further specialization, as Odalai says. Antimony said it would really add depth compared with, you know, small city 1-2 empire district spamming, which is too strong at the moment. Yeah, you know, with the mid to late game, okay, where can I place a city? Dan, why would you want to place a city right now? The game is going to be over. There's all this production. Well, all I'm doing is I wanted to construct a commercial hub, so I'm looking for places where there are no cities. It's marginal land, but there's, you know, some forests or jungle I can chop, so I can construct that commercial hub and then have a trade route. And now that city is paid for itself. I don't care what else it does or does not do.
Don't lie, Dan. You're just score EPing.
Well, there's that too, Phil. You know.
That's not too. That is the primary motivator. You're not wrong for doing it, by the way. But come on, let's be honest here. You don't need that city.
What is your style, Mackie, according to Victoria? And is that true? Do you think that that is a fair assessment of you when you, in fact, do speak, of which you do, in fact, speak?
Yeah, that I tend to be the one that doesn't go on the long 10-minute ramble, and I just sort of bloop right in and go, excuse me, but.
Exactly. And it's also worth pointing out that a couple of the threads that were discussed last episode, bringing back the height advantage, ideas for tall play, got a response to that thread because someone acknowledged, well, it was discussed on the latest Polycast, so here's my 2 cents. And that also happened in the tall versus wide thread, which was also linked to from that discussion. And specifically from that, so Stratus said, it's a bit interesting how the term tall is defined differently. If you listen to the Polycast, when the host, who evidently played a lot of Civ 5, come to this topic, they focus in on tall versus wide to mean number of cities. There is also the other aspect, which relates to distribution of population between multiple cities, that is to say, core versus frontier. I think the reason it focuses on the number of cities is because when you're talking about optimal for tall empires in Civ 5, we're thinking less about the distribution of population between multiple cities and the number of cities that you have.
Yeah. Core versus frontier is very dependent on the modifiers available in the given game. When you get the multiplicative modifiers, the core city concept becomes a lot stronger. That's why you saw it in Civ 4, which didn't even have the tall versus wide consideration. That wasn't even in anyone's mindset, because there was not this contrived trade-off between the two. Even then, you had a core of cities. That concept existed because of how strong the multiplicative multipliers were.
Yes, and in fact, when I think of core versus frontier, I think of a wide empire. Because you've got all of these cities, here's the core. Here are all the cities that are on the frontier, that are on the outer edges, around your core cities.
Yeah, and they serve a purpose, usually either to do something specific or to support the modifiers that are stronger in the core cities, one or the other. Or they just crank units, and that's the thing as well. Going back to whip cities, or cities that just get to a certain population, work a certain amount of hammers, cogs, shields, and then just hammer units out so you can defend yourself, whatever. They're there.
Admittedly, we're talking about a wide empire. Usually your frontier cities are cities that at some point you captured from somebody else, so you probably don't value them as much, so they can just be meat shields if necessary to slow down an army to prevent them from attacking your core cities that are really driving whatever it is that you're doing. And then you kind of use it as an early warning system, and then you just go and crush them and turn and capture the city. Capture the city, take the city back, and then take even more cities.
You know what really should be your early warning system, though?
Nukes?
Scouts. No, nukes are your response to your early warning system, or to deny your opponent any actual use of their early warning system. But you don't pay maintenance on scouts. Scouts can see units coming, and between them and walls, you should have time to position your units.
Yeah. Yes, we appreciate the feedback from episode 289.
Recorded for episode 295 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Majin, and Mega Bears Fan.
My first game playing as Persia, where there was this just huge mountain range spreading from north to south across the continent, and literally left one tile of pass on the northern coast and on the southern coast, and then having to fight a war with Macedon, who was right on the other side of that mountain on the southern edge, and there just being that going back and forth with him. And then on top of that, there just happened to be a city-state, like, right there at that spot that we were fighting over back and forth for, I think, like, pretty much the entire first half of the game before I finally took it from him and kept it.
Okay, because I was going to ask two questions, and you answered one already, which was when you're saying you're fighting Macedon over this city-state, is that the literal fighting, or you're trying to remain or become their suzerain so then they then join the war effort against you? Okay, that makes sense.
Well, it was both. It started out as, oh, send them a trade route, try to do quests and stuff like that, but Alexander apparently really wanted them to, and eventually Alexander just said, screw it, and just captured the city, and I was like, no. So I had to go take it back from him, and then we just fought back and forth for it. Yeah, it was fun.
Okay, so when you got it back, you made it part of your empire? You didn't liberate it?
Yes, and that was mostly so that I could quickly build an encampment and just get lots of bombardment in order to completely lock out him from crossing the land in order to get to my other cities. So he was the aggressor against the city-state, and I was the aggressor against him.
Wait, were you in the north or were you in the south?
I basically controlled the entire eastern part of the map, but if he's going to get through, he's going to have to do it with ships later in the game. I've noticed that Civ 6 favors mountains a lot more than the previous games do, and I do see a lot more frequently large ranges of mountains.
Well, I wasn't surprised when you said it was Macedon that was gobbling up city-states, because they really, really like to do that early on, and you've got to put them in their place, because they already don't suffer from war weariness, and now they're getting these cities early on that they're adding to their empire, which is quote-unquote just fantastic. So what was the conclusion to this game? Or was the game, or is it, there's still no conclusion because the game hasn't finished? Like, who won this battle?
I ended up winning that particular conflict, but I didn't finish the game to an actual victory, as happens so often with Civ games. It was, like I said, it was basically just my first game with Persia. I was just trying out the new DLC, and then basically the next DLC came out, and I tried that one, and never went back to that game. But I did smack Alexander down and conquer all of his cities and stuff like that eventually.
So you did wipe Macedon out?
I didn't wipe him out, but I, like, captured his capital and left him with two little cities somewhere, five population or some crap like that. So made him uneventful on the world stage.
Oh, do you still have a save from this? Could you go back to this game if you wanted to?
Probably. Why, do you want me to send it to you?
No, I'm giving you homework.
Oh, okay. Wonderful.
If you want it.
Teacher Dan is teaching.
Yeah,
exactly. Do you need me to write an essay on it, too?
No, just a report's fine.
Oh, okay.
Full sentences, let's say five paragraphs, 6 to 8 sentences per paragraph. I want double-spaced and title page, bibliography.
Well, how about all of you? Does anyone else have any other super memorable game experiences that you want to write an essay on, or just things in general that make Civ games memorable to you?
Most of my memorable Civilization VI games from 2017, or even 2016, actually, are multiplayer, and that's for assorted reasons, but it's usually because it's a shared experience, obviously, with other people who are in the game, and for those of you listening, these are cooperative or cooperative-ish games, more accurately, where we're going to attack the artificial intelligence. And actually, my favorite games are those where there is a decent spread, and by that, I mean it's, oh, I'm not next to another human player within the first 15 or 20 turns, that there's a chance to spread out, first of all, but it's not having to spread out too much for so long that the artificial intelligence starts to run away, and then it becomes a mass slog. You know you're eventually going to win, but how many turns do we want to go through to get to that point, to the in-house rule where there are no AIs left on the map? In those games,
when the artificial intelligence is also smart enough to not what I call essentially rage quit. There was a recent multiplayer game, and it really stands out in my mind, and it's part of a Turncast episode, where I'm fighting China, and I've taken their three cities on the border with me. It's a continent-style map. The thing is, they have their other cities farther out on other parts of the continent that kind of do this little jut, and there really isn't a lot in terms of water, and I don't have any navy at all. So I'm like, I'm going to have to reroute and go back around, and it's going to take, you know, if I get a peace treaty with China, it's going to take at least that many turns in order to get the units to the other side to take them. Plus, the AI still has all these freaking forests and jungles that they haven't bothered to chop, which, first off, is great for defense when I'm sitting outside of their city, but it's going to slow my units down, and then I need time for the units that I've got to heal, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought, just give me gold per turn. Honestly, give me something. Give me some kind of restitution. And I knew Mackie in particular would appreciate that. And China's response, first they said they would accept that deal, which was good. I was getting their maximum gold per turn. It was in the 70s plus a few hundred other gold up front. And then I thought, you know, I would actually like these couple of other cities that I'm already fighting on the border, but I'm not going to be able to quite take. I'm thinking, they're eventually going to be able to wear my units down. My reinforcements are too far away. I'm not going to be able to back my troops out enough to be able to heal, so they're going to die. And the AI's like, yeah, China's like, yeah, I'll give you those cities. And I thought, hey, that's good. Then I clicked on another city, and I thought, how far can I go with this? They gave me every single one of their cities except their capital. Yes, I had impressive military strength against them, but it was so over above and beyond what they should have given me. So I enjoyed that game just because of how ridiculous it was, in the sense of, wow, this is going to save like 15, 20 minutes anyway, and that many turns or more of playing the game in order to get to that resolution. But it was also sad in the sense that the AI did not recognize that, you know, you don't have to give it all away because, hey, this is great. I get the cities right away. They'll continue to grow because they're not occupied. I can start doing things with these cities. I can start moving my units throughout the empire to position myself to get around their capital, which they've now allowed to be surrounded by my empire because they gave me another half dozen cities on top of the three that I already captured. But it definitely stands out in my mind as both the good and the bad that you can experience from the artificial intelligence, which is shared across single player or multiplayer, but also being able to tell people in my multiplayer game, look what I did.
Right, now take an army and help us with the other AI.
No. I'm just sorry, Mackie. My units have to heal, and you know, the roads, you know, we can't just build roads willy-nilly now. It has to be based on trade routes, and there really aren't that many, and I just, no.
Yes.
I wouldn't want to take the satisfaction away from you of being able to do that to your AI, so I'm really doing you a favor when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm getting a choice finger and maybe a thumb where I don't want, but anyway.
There's definitely an eyebrow over here.
Is it a Spock eyebrow?
Yes.
Oh, the best kind, thank you. So that was clearly not one of Mackie's favorite games. It does say most memorable, admittedly. Memorable doesn't necessarily mean favorite. I mean, after all, you got negative emotions attached to something. You're probably going to remember it more readily than something that you're really gushing over with positivity. Although I think I know what amongst Mackie's most memorable games are, and they're also multiplayer, and those would be the games where someone else was Australia other than you. I know those were your favorite games, Mackie. There's no reason to not say so and not acknowledge it aloud. So, yeah.
Oh, my Civ, give.
And you see, that's for people listening to Polycast who have not listened to Turncast. It is the kind of in-house rule that Mackie can only be Australia every other session, every other week. Otherwise, she would always choose Australia. We don't want her to become addicted to going down under. I don't know what would possibly have warranted that response from you there, Mackie, but...
Uh-huh.
Given the frequency with which you play them, I think you earned that one, to be fair.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series official website at
thepolycast.net.
Record date sorted. 2017. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.